Rolling Stone considers Richard Thompson to be one of the top 20 guitarists of all time. He's also an influential songwriter and founder of the British folk rock group Fairport Convention. He's written a new book about the years 1967 to 1975. It's called Beeswing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice. It's a memoir about a period of great musical change and creativity. He called from London to talk about his book and music, and I asked him what motivated him to write this book.
For me, it was a very intense time. I was a teenager growing up in London. Became a professional musician when I was 18, and the next 10 years or so was just so busy and so head-on. So much happened in that time period that for me it was an interesting time to write about. And also, other people ask me a lot about that time, what it was like in the 60s. So hopefully I'm able to communicate some of that in the book.
Yeah. Well, the story of Fairport Convention very rightly takes up a good deal of this book. And I learned that you picked up the guitar at a very young age and you started taking lessons when you were 11. And as you said, when you were a teenager, you became one of the founders of Fairport. Britain was right in the midst of youth culture or hippie culture. Could you set that scene for us? What was going on around you?
Yeah, it probably paralleled what was happening in somewhere like San Francisco. Yeah, long hair was fashionable. Yeah, whole change of clothing style suddenly, and sort of the hippie look became very common. And I think '67 was really the beginning of this psychedelic phase in British music. Bands like the Pink Floyd, Soft Machine, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown were playing psychedelic music, and a lot of other bands who weren't particularly psychedelic rode in on that wave. People like the Incredible String Band and even some of the blues bands kind of cashed in, if you like, on the psychedelic movement. And Fairport was one of the bands that never thought of themselves as psychedelic, but suddenly, almost as soon as we'd formed, there was lots of work around. We could work, 7 nights a week if we wanted to. And it was comparatively easy to get signed to a record label because the record labels were frantically signing anything that moved, really. So it was an exciting time. London was the center of youth fashion. It was one of the centers of music at that time. So it was just a great time to be a teenager and getting a foothold in that world.
Yeah. Fairport Convention became a groundbreaking group with a big impact on the music scene. What was that process like? And how did the group finally find its niche as an innovative folk rock band that it was?
When we started out, we were playing a lot of singer-songwriter music. Well, we really love lyrics. We love the work of Dylan, we love Phil Oakes, we love Richard Farina. We got hold of Joni Mitchell's demos before she made a record. We got hold of the Basement Tapes before anybody else had heard them. So we loved all that singer-songwriter stuff. But we were still very imitative of American music styles and music forms, as most people were in Britain at that time. But at a certain point, in 1968, really, we started to play traditional songs from the British Isles, from England, Ireland, Scotland. And I think a light bulb went off at a certain point, and we said, this is something that we should really specialize in, and that will make us a bit more unique, and will make us a bit truer to our own heritage, our own roots, and it will be something that we can excel at, just as some of the bands we admire in America, like the Byrds or The Band, excel at being, kind of roots-connected bands. Well, we should be the same in a very British sense. So that really sets us off in that direction.
You just were talking about how fascinated you were with words in the music, but honestly, it seems that the guitar has been one of your big loves. I mean, you write wonderful lyrics too, but what is it about the guitar that made it your instrument of choice?
I think when I was very small, guitars seemed to be everywhere. My dad was not a very good guitar player, but he had great guitar records. So I grew up, from the age of zero, listening to Django Reinhardt and Les Paul. And then when rock and roll hit Britain, you know, I was 5 years old, my sister was 10 years old, and she started buying, you know, Elvis, Gene Vincent, Buddy Holly, lots of Buddy Holly. So there was guitars everywhere, so I thought, well, this is obviously something that I should be playing. It just seemed like the coolest thing to do, really. And when a guitar finally turned up in the house when I was about 11, I dedicated myself to it, and I took classical lessons for a year or two, but mostly learned by ear, and really just tried to keep my ears open and to listen to everything that was out there.
Mm. You also say in your book, and I think I have just noticed this over time with the music that you make, that it's been really important to you to stay authentic and true to your musical path. And you are a talented person to the extent that, you know, not everybody can do that and still remain viable, but you can still make a living. How would you describe the path that you follow now?
It's not that different from what we chose to do in 1969. I mean, I really want to be a songwriter and a musician in a line that goes back through the folk traditions of Great Britain. You know, I'm fairly true to that. Within those boundaries, you know, somewhere between folk and rock, if you like, there's a lot to explore. There's a lot of interesting places to go. Plus, once you're happy that you've got a basis for your style, you can bring in other things. Yeah, you can bring in bits of other cultures, you know, if you want to. And it still remains you. It still remains your style, rather than being a plagiarist. So I really think I kind of tread the same path. And as you said, I just try to be true to my roots.
That is the voice of Richard Thompson, and we're talking about his music and his new book. It's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. As I read your book, there were so many musicians and places and songs and events. I could never have kept it all straight. Now, how did you recall so many details so precisely for the book?
I think when I started writing it, I realized how very selective my memory actually was. There's so much stuff I don't recall, which is a real problem. There are some things that I was very happy to jot down because they're very fresh in my mind. So writing the anecdotes was easy and lots of fun to do that. Putting the chronology together was much harder because I didn't keep a journal. Lots of people who kept records lost those records. You know, companies like, you know, Island Records, our old booking agency, they lost their records. So it was tough. I had to go to websites that claimed to have every Fairport Convention show ever. But even those are incomplete, so it was a problem. So that was the hardest thing, was stitching it all together and trying to put it into some kind of coherent timeline.
Right, and with so much going on and it being, you know, such an amazing time for music and cultural change, I'm sure there were lots of things to recall. And, of course, living the lifestyle of a musician might not have helped that at all either.
No, it's true. I mean, there are definitely times where I'm just a blank. People say, oh, do you remember doing this? Do you remember doing that? And I say, well, I'm really sorry. You know, I must have been, you know, too drunk or drugged up or something. But it's just gone. I just can't find it in my brain. That those synapses have long since perished. So just write about stuff that I did remember.
Yeah, there are some really, like you said, anecdotes, stories of life on the road, touring, playing gigs. But then you do, and I want to touch on this, you do talk about tragic crash where two lives were lost. And I'm just thinking it would have a devastating effect on everybody that was there, including yourself. How did you cope with that?
I'm not sure that we did cope with it. I mean, we had an accident in 1969 that killed our drummer, killed my girlfriend, and it put us in a state of deep shock, I think, and we really weren't sure whether we would continue as a band, whether we wanted to still be musicians, being out on the road, if that was the price that we had to pay. It seemed a very high price. And we really thought long and hard about that. We decided eventually to carry on, if only for the memory of the people that we lost. But I think it really unsettled us for a couple of years, at least, after that. And I think some of the decisions that we made, you know, people left the band. Maybe they wouldn't have left under other circumstances. I think, well, we were really irrational and probably suffering from, you know, PTSD for a while. But in those days, you know, still quite close to World War II, it was kind of, well, you've been through this and that, but stiff upper lip and you just have to get on with life. And that was really the approach that we were handed. No one said, well, you have to go to therapy. That was never even a thought, I don't think. So we really just kind of picked ourselves up and got on with it.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been surprising if the band had broken up after that, at least in my thinking. And yet the band continues today, which is quite an achievement.
It is an achievement, yeah. Well, I think Furpo was always almost bigger than the sum of its parts and the people in the band. The band had a kind of reputation, and it had a very established style. And you still have a couple of fairly founding members in the band to keep that stability going. And, you know, if someone leaves at some point, then it's not a great tragedy. The band will soldier on. It's actually amazing that they are still going. We had a big 50th anniversary festival a couple of years ago. I'll play in the band every couple of years, at reunion festivals. But I'm very proud that they do soldier on. I think it's great that they're still out there playing.
You know, you live in the United States now, but one of the fun parts of your book was the telling of some of your first impressions of coming to the United States when you toured here. Could you tell us one of the stories from your early touring in the United States and your impressions of it?
Well, I think one of the main impressions was, you know, in 1970, America seemed like a country divided generationally. If you were a young person, if you dressed like a hippie, if you had long hair, you know, you wore buckskin jackets and jeans and stuff, then older people would immediately form an opinion about you. So for Fairport, who looked like that at the time, we were surprised at the hostility that we were met with by anybody over the age of about 35. That really shocked us. One of the examples I give in the book is we were in a coffee shop in Detroit Airport, and we were having, you know, breakfast before our flight, and we hear these comments from the next booth, you know about, you know, get your hair cut, you know, isn't she pretty, you know, those kind of things. And I look around the side of the booth, and I see these guys in, you know, Stetson hats and very smart maxi jackets and Western ties, you know, and it's Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, you know, but people I admired. I had their records at home. You know, I thought, wow, Buck Owens. we're being insulted by Buck Owens and the Buckaroos. I mean, it seemed kind of bizarre, you know, that someone I admired so much was actually slagging us off, was bad-mouthing us. You have to read the book to get the punchline, but it was a very bizarre experience.
In this book also, just to change to an entirely different topic, you describe that you have been always a seeker and you've been asking spiritual questions most of your adult life. And you came to find a home in Islam and Sufism. And I know that it's Ramadan right now. How has this affected your life and your music?
I don't think it changed me particularly. I think I was always that person. I always wanted to have that particular connection to, you know, the universe, if you like. I always wanted to know my place in the universe. You know, it's helped me to steer my way through the, you know, shark-infested waters of the music business, if you like. You know, it gives me a kind of a grid of reference every day, how to deal with life, how to deal with death. So it's just, it's a path I've chosen. Other people choose other paths, and I'm happy with that. But it just helps me to deal with life and to have some understanding of the inner workings of myself and the universe.
Will you be writing another book about your experiences after 1975?
Well, I stopped there because I thought, you know, 76 to 80 weren't particularly interesting. I didn't really like the records that we made, and I didn't want to write kind of negatively about that time period. So I'd have to skip forward a bit to sort of 81 to pick it up again. Or I could skip, you know, volume 2, 3, 4, and 5 and pick it up in volume 6. That might be a bit more interesting.
I just wanted to tell you that I listened to a Facebook Live of you playing music from your home last spring, and that was pretty early on in the pandemic. And it seemed like it was a little bit weird for you to be performing without seeing a live audience. But on my end, as a person listening, it felt really intimate and genuine. And I wanted to thank you for that music. It was something we all needed at the time.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. I mean, you're very welcome. It was a joy to do it in many ways, if only to keep that connection with the audience. And it is strange to play something and you know people are listening, and you know that they appreciate it because you see the comments in the chat column, you know. But it'll be very nice to get back in front of a live audience, I think. That'll be an absolute joy. And, you know, a few shows are trickling in. I've got some festivals coming up over the summer, which will be great. And next year is jam-packed, so I hope all that happens. And it's going to be really nice to come out of this this kind of lockdown time and get back to the job I love to do.
Yes, that's going to be great for all of us. Now, Beeswing is the title of your book, but it's also the title of a song from your Mirror Blue album. And that song is set in the period that's covered by this book. And I think it's a beautiful song. Could you tell us about the song and its characters?
Yeah, I think the song is about people who fall through society's safety net, if you like, or sometimes voluntarily jump through society's safety net. And a lot of the people I knew in the 60s did that. You know, they dropped out, that they didn't want to take the path well-traveled. They didn't want to be like their parents. They didn't want to go into straight jobs. So they wanted to do something different. They were looking for different things, you know, in an earthbound way and in a spiritual way, I think. So, for me, that song sums up some attitudes, at least, of the 60s. So that was really the reason that I wanted to make that the title of the book.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Maggie. It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.